So let me start by briefly recapitulating what we have done yesterday. So we started studying gravitational waves, and we did that in the linearized theory. So we considered the linearized vacuum Einstein equations, which can be written as this: boson H mu nu equals to zero, and for example, the Lorentz gauge condition, d mu H mu nu equals to zero. So that's our theory, which is of course valid when the gravitational field is weak and when we can treat it as a small perturbation of the flat space. And then we actually realized we can find solutions which look like plane waves. So we have some polarization tensor here, epsilon mu nu, and then simply an exponential of ikx, where k is the corresponding wave vector. And so we found that these things indeed are solutions of our vacuum Einstein equations, provided that this wave vector k is simply null, so k squared equals to zero, which tells us that the gravitational waves actually do propagate at the speed of light. And then we showed also that we actually can use the gauge freedom, so this equation here and the remaining gauge freedom, to actually eliminate basically all components of epsilon mu nu. So we started with 10 components of epsilon mu nu, but after complete gauge fixing, we actually reduced this down to 2 degrees of freedom. So epsilon mu nu had only 2 independent components, if you want. And they are called, we call them epsilon plus and epsilon cross in our specific gauge. Of course, you know, the fact that we can go to 2 degrees of freedom is just a special case of the theorem I told you in the front-end course, is that, you know, we start with a field theory which has 10 degrees of freedom, which are the apparent degrees of freedom. So these are the apparent ones. And then we know that there is a corresponding gauge freedom. We can go from H mu nu to H mu nu plus nu xi nu plus d nu xi mu. Okay, and so our gauge function is just a vector here. So that's our gauge function. And then we have this beautiful formula that the number of true degrees of freedom, so number of true degrees of freedom, is simply the number of the apparent ones, which is 10. And then I can use each gauge function twice. So it's minus 2 times 4, which is, of course, 2 true degrees of freedom. So extremely useful formula. So without actually doing any explicit gauge fixing, you already know the result. You are looking for 2 degrees of freedom because you have a gauge function which is a vector. Yes?
Sorry, why can we use them twice?
Well, we have seen yesterday explicitly. So we could use this function here that gives you 4 equations, but then there was a residual gauge freedom, right? So we could still do extra coordinate transformation preserving this harmonic gauge, right? And so we saw it explicitly. You will see it even more explicitly today in the tutorial. So there, everything will be super nice and super explicit. Okay, but anyway, so this is the theorem. And so it gives the right number of degrees of freedom. So really, gravity in vacuum propagates only 2 degrees of freedom. And so if you want, correspondingly, you have 2 polarizations of gravitational waves. So for example, if you consider a wave in the x direction, so the wave is propagating that way. So then you can, the effect of the wave on a ring of test particles is precisely this one here. So if I start with something which looks circular, then what the wave, as it passes by, what it's doing is doing like that. Okay, so that's this type of polarization. And the cross polarization is doing exactly the same thing, but now it's just 45 degrees tilted. Okay, so that's what it really, the gravitational wave as it passes by, what it does. And of course, this was finally measured by LIGO. And so the first event they actually measured was due 14th of September 2015. And they measured basically gravitational waves which came from a collision of 2 black holes in a binary black hole system. It was very, very far away. Okay, so there was a couple of surprises, as we shall see later. So first of all, these black holes were quite big, and that is quite unexpected. You wouldn't expect that big black holes. Second, the spin of the black holes was actually not so high. So So astrophysicists assume that the black holes actually should rotate very, very fast. And these black holes do not rotate that fast. So there was lots of surprises by this measurement. But anyway, so these people got a Nobel Prize. So Barry, Storm, and Weiss. And so now this, I think it's really the biggest discovery of our scientific lifetime. And so this was really non-trivial thing. And it took exactly almost 100 years after Einstein predicted gravitational waves to actually measure them. So basically, he wrote everything you needed to know about gravitational waves in 1916 or something like that. And then it took really 100 years to measure these things, to measure how the space-time is squeezed by the gravitational waves. So compared to this, of course, measurement of Higgs is just a baby problem, right? That took only 50 years. So this is twice as long. All right. So that's first Nobel Prize for general relativity. So now we are going to go backwards in time, and I'll show you the calculation which led to another Nobel Prize in general relativity, which was actually much earlier than this one. All right, so for that, we have to study really how much radiation is produced by an isolated system, for example, by this binary system when it is colliding. So how much energy is irradiated away from the system by gravitational waves. And so we are heading here. So typically, isolated system is something small. So I describe this by R prime. But it's just really something located and then, you know, quite isolated, and there's nothing. So T mu is non-trivial here. But it's only non-trivial in the finite region. So for example, you have two stars. So it's only non-trivial there. And then, you know, this produces gravitational waves. And these gravitational waves propagate towards the observer, who is far, far away. And so we have two conditions, that it's the observer is far, far away. And then, you know, the approximation which we have done here is only valid when the frequency is actually smaller than the typical size of the system. And so these are the two conditions which we have. And of course, to find how much gravitational waves, or what is the corresponding gravitational field produced by the system, we just use the retarded potential formula, which we derived in the front end. So you find the retarded Green's function, and then you solve the full Einstein equation, which now has T mu on the right-hand side. And so this is the solution. And of course, you know that there is a time dilatation. So of course, the gravitational waves produce on the light cone, propagate on the light cone. So if you have an observer here, and of course, the observer only sees signals which are coming on the light cone. Okay, and so the source has to be exactly on the light cone. And that precisely corresponds to the fact that the source actually had to be in a time, which is the retarded time, which is t minus the distance r minus r prime, treating the speed of light as one. Okay, so that's what this solution tells you. So now you use that solution. And it's advantageous to actually write down what a Fourier transform of this solution is. So this is your h mu nu bar given here. And then you Fourier transform in the omega in the time. So this is a function of omega. And then I showed you in a couple of steps yesterday, and then using some approximation, that you can actually write it reasonably well as something which goes like 1 over r. R. Over r. And of course, that's what you would expect the radiative field to behave. Because of course, the power of how much energy is radiated away will be proportional to h mu nu square, as it is in electromagnetism. And so then this falls off like 1 over r square. And so that it gives a non-trivial contribution on the sphere when you integrate over r square sine theta, whatever. Okay, so every radiative field has to go like 1 over r. If it falls off more quickly, for example, like 1 over r square, you will not measure anything at infinity. Okay, so this is the radiative field which we found. So now, let us just bring it to some nicer form. So this is already nice, but we still have this T mu nu here. So we can use several tricks to bring it into a little bit nicer form, which is related to the quadrupole of the source. Okay, so how do you do that? So first of all, let me notice some fact that really you don't need all the components h mu nu tilde. All you need is the spatial components of h mu nu tilde. Okay, so note that we don't need all h mu nu tilde. We only need the spatial part. Only need hij tilde. So only the spatial components of this are actually interesting. So how to see that is, of course, I can use my Lorentz gauge condition or whatever. So you have, so to prove this is that we have this equation, mu nu bar equals to zero. That's our Lorentz gauge condition. And so if you translate that into, of course, so now if I write this in terms of the Fourier space, so then the time derivative just brings down omega, and the spatial derivative remains here. Okay, so I split it into dt ht nu, but dt ht nu, when I do the Fourier transformation, it will just bring me down omega, and then spatial derivatives remain the same. Okay, so this just reduces to, so this is the same as in the Fourier space, ht mu, and this is given by 1 I over omega, and the spatial part of this hi mu, like that. So now I'm writing this like if it were true. I'm actually finding a minus sign. So if you can catch up some signs, I think it should be plus, but I'm finding, whenever I do the calculation, I'm finding plus I over omega here. But anyway, so please try it. So anyway, so this omega, of course, comes from the dt thing, and this is the spatial part. Okay, so that's just that for the transformation of this thing here. So now I can consider various mu's, right? So first of all, I can consider mu equal to j. Okay, so now set mu equals to j, and then you know that h tilde dj is just I over omega of di hij tilde. So if we know what hij tilde is, you also know what htj tilde is by simply taking a derivative. Okay? Yes?
I just want to make sure I'm following. So we have a tilde on our h, but we should also have a bar.
Yeah, sure. So I just defined it this way, without a bar, so that I don't have tilde and bar. But what I mean is just a Fourier transformation of h bar. Yeah. Thank you for that question. Anything else is wrong or suspicious? All right. So we have that. And then, of course, we can also find h tilde tt. Well, okay. So I'm plugging now mu equal to t. Mu equals to t, and then this is equal to I over omega. Now, using this formula, is di h I t tilde, right? But I already know what h I t tilde is from here. It's symmetric, of course. So this gives me that this is minus 1 over omega square, and then I will have di dj h ij tilde. So this is a proof that really all that matters is just the spatial components of these things. Yes?
It's just, well, if the metric is time dependent, when we raise our indexes in h tilde mu, I mean, we will have an integration of the metric in, like, if I want to raise indices of the h bar.
No, but you are always raising with the flat metric here, right? You're just doing the linear perturbation.
Okay.
Yeah, so everything here is at the linearized level. So I only keep everything into the order of h. So then I'm just using flat metric for everything, rising, lower indices, or whatever. So anyway, so this is the proof. So once I know what hij is, of course, by taking one derivative, I recover these components. And by taking two derivatives, I recover those components. So all I need is the spatial part. So that's first remark. Second remark is this bloody trick. I'll say it's another bloody trick. Trick here. So what we really need to calculate is, of course, this d3 r prime t mu nu tilde. Okay, or if you just consider the spatial part, just tij tilde. But we can simplify this calculation to something which is quite nice. And for that, we use the conservation of the energy momentum tensor. So we also have our energy momentum tensor is conserved. So we have that d mu nu equals to zero. All right, and that means, of course, then again, if I Fourier transform this into time to omega, then this just gives us that minus the spatial part of t tilde k mu is equal to I omega t tilde t mu. Okay, so I can relate. So this is just the same thing, but now in the Fourier space. And then, of course, it's the same thing exactly as we are doing here. You can relate the spatial divergence to simply multiplying by omega on the right-hand side. Okay, so we have that. So now let's look at that theorem here. So we have these three.
Why can we use the partial derivative instead of covariant derivative?
Again, we are at the linearized level, so we assume that the mu is already small. Right? Otherwise, this wouldn't be linearized gravity. And so basically, you know, gamma terms or whatever would be of the order of h. So we would have double small thing.
Even if the t mu mu is small, even if we are far away, we also consider that the t mu mu is small.
Ah, OK, very good. So of course, I have to be consistent, right? So I'm using simply the linearized equations to describe everything here. I'm still assuming that the gravity is weak and everything, even at the system, right? Even at the system. Okay, I'm just doing, you know, simple calculation. So this is at the level of the linearized gravity, and then you have just this partial conservation. All right, so now what we have to calculate is this d3r of t mu nu tilde. So let's just calculate the tij, because we can recover all the other components. So tij, I put, for some reason, the indices up, it doesn't matter. Tij of omega and r. Of course, we should be integrating over r prime, but it's just a dummy variable, so it doesn't matter. So we can just do over r. All right, so we have that. So now look at the beauty. So we can just write a stupid identity, a dirty trick, and then use this thing here. So let's do it. So this is equal to d3 of r. And then the stupid identity is this one here. So you differentiate with respect to k. And then you put xi. And then you put tkj. And then minus xi dk tkj. And then this is d3 of r. So let's see if this works. So this is just integration by parts, basically. Of course, tildes are still there. Thank you. Tildes are still here. So now let's see what happens. So if I differentiate the first term here, of course, I get delta ik. OK, so this is just t tilde ij, which is what I had before. But also, I can differentiate the other one, and I'm subtracting that term there. Okay, so this is still fine. So now why I'm doing this is that, of course, this is just a total derivative of something. And so I can turn it into a boundary term. Okay, so if you turn it into a boundary term, so this is just a boundary term. And of course, I am clever enough. So what we are doing is that we are integrating over this isolated system, right? So there should be everywhere, there should be the primes. Right? So we are integrating over isolated systems. So if I make a circle around the isolated system, which is bigger than the isolated system, there won't be any matter. Right? So then t mu nu is equal to zero. So but the system is isolated, but system is isolated. And so then what it means is that this is just zero. Right? So I just go sufficiently far away from the system, and then I integrate over that boundary, and that will be zero because T mu is zero there. Okay, so this term does not contribute. And so then we have that term only. But now I can use this thing here. So I can turn this dk tk j to just multiplication by I omega of tt j. Okay, so this is now equal to, this is now equal to I omega integral over d3 r xi t tilde dj. Okay, everybody happy so far? It's just a dirty trick. Okay, so what we have managed to do is that basically we started with something where we integrate over dij. Okay, but we can basically trade this I for t by multiplying by xi. All right, so now we can do it again. So of course the aim is to do that we trade this index j for another t, so we will have tt, and then we will multiply by xj. Okay, so use again, trick again. And in order to do that, you have to basically symmetrize over the indices, but it doesn't matter, so it's done in the study text. What you find that this is just equal to minus omega square over 2, so the 2 is precisely from symmetrization between I and j thing, but okay. And then integral over d3 r xi xj t tt tilde omega r. Okay, so what should be surprising at this point is just this one half, but it simply comes out of the calculation if you use the trick again. And the fact is, of course, if I differentiate this thing here, xi, xj, ttt, with respect to xk, now I'm differentiating x square. So that's the origin of one half. Okay? So, oh, very good. So now we have that. And this is super beautiful, because if you look at the last object, well, what is ttt? We discussed last time that ttt is something like energy density. Okay? So then we have energy density multiplied by length, multiplied by length. This is precisely the definition of the quadrupole. Okay, so you have mass times length square is a quadrupole. Okay, so this is the quadrupole, so let's call it ij. And so here, of course, it's a function of omega. So it's a Fourier transformation of the quadrupole. This is a quadrupole.
The dipole doesn't radiate like the previous approximation, so radiate.
Exactly. Oh no, I broke it.
When did it start working then?
Can I go to?
Haha. Oh no, it tilted again.
Oh no.
Well, actually, once it fell down, so this is a very dangerous situation.
It fell down.
It did, yeah, in the past. So it's a disaster. Oh, no. So, okay, so let's be quiet as possible. No. No earthquakes, hopefully. Okay, so what did we find here? So we have the formula for h mu. Yes?
Can you explain the trick, how you got use the conservation of the t mu to get the derivative is equal to I omega t?
Oh, so you agree that the first term is zero because we are in the isolated system.
Yeah.
So then the second term is this one here. You agree with that?
Yeah.
It's just an identity. I'm just writing this as an identity. This is just an identity, right? So now I'm using this thing here, right? I know that dk tk j is I omega tj. right? So I'm plugging mu equal to.
Why is that?
Oh, that's just the, okay, so you're asking about the second line.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just a Fourier transformation of this, the first line.
Okay.
Right, so I have d mu t mu nu, of course, that is, you know, if I plug for mu equal to t, it's the derivative dt of dt nu plus spatial derivative di ti nu, right? But if I'm in Fourier space, the time derivative just brings down I omega.
Okay.
Right, so this is in the Fourier space. All right, so we have that. All right, so let's use our beautiful formula. We have H ij tilde, which is a function of omega and r. Omega and r is this 4g e to I omega r divided by r, and then this d3 r prime of tij tilde, but that's precisely here. So it's times minus omega square over 2, and then I tilde ij of omega. Right? That's what it is. So in other words, we just found how our metric produced by the isolated system looks like in terms of the quadrupole. Okay? And we found explicit expression basically in the Fourier space, in the omega space. So the last thing is to go back to the position space. Okay, so then we go to ij bar t of r. Okay, so what is this? So you have 4g divided by 2 is 2g. That's minus 2g, okay, in 1 over square root of 2 pi, and then integral e to minus I omega t d omega of this thing here, which is minus minus 2g omega square e to I omega r divided by r, and then e tilde ij of omega. Right, so we are going back to the Fourier space. But now look at the beauty. So of course, this omega square, well, each multiplication by omega in the Fourier space corresponds to a time derivative in the position space. If I do time derivative in the position space, then I bring down one omega, right? So this thing is just an origin of two time derivatives of something. Right? So this just gives me d over dt square. And then if you look at this thing here, so we are integrating over omega. And so what is in the exponential? In the exponential is t. It's minus t plus r. Okay? But if you look at the definition of the retarded time, it is t minus r. And we neglected r prime because r prime is much, much smaller than r. So basically what you are writing here is that I can write here t retarded and get rid of this term here. Right? So we have t minus r, which is precisely the definition of the retarded time. I'm absorbing here. And then you see, it's no surprise, that the result is just given by so this thing is just, okay, let me just write it. It's just 2g over r, and then d square ij, now as a function of time, dt square. But I did the Fourier transformation so that my t is actually tr. So t equals to tr. And that's what it is, hij. It's hij bar. It's just given by this beautiful formula. Okay, so my perturbation of the metric, as observed by the distant observer is just given by two time derivatives of the quadrupole moment of the system. Also, of course, because the quadrupole moment is there, the formula is called quadrupole formula. Quadrupole formula. And so this is super interesting and super amazing. So now you know really, you know, the perturbation you are receiving as an observer, it just depends on the time derivatives of the quadrupole of the system. Okay.
How close are these formulas to the ones that people actually use to analyze the LIGO data?
Yeah, of course.
I'm asking how close they are.
No. So this is basically what people use.
Okay, so people really do use this. It's
yeah.
Super fancy version of this.
No. So no. Okay. Well, anyway, so I think that's correct. I think. So we have that. Of course, you know, there are high order effects. So we basically went to. So I wasn't completely correct. So we just went to linearized gravity, right? So you capture some feature of the full strong gravitational field by going to linearized gravity. But if you want to describe collision of two black holes, of course the field is strong there, right? So then you have to go to next order. So actually this will be the leading thing. So this is good enough for collision of two stars or whatever, maybe even neutron stars, but probably not. For normal stars, this is good enough. For collision of two black holes, it's not good enough, and then you have to go to higher order. So sorry, I wasn't correct. All right, so this is the beautiful formula, quadrupole formula. You will use this formula today in the lecture to calculate how much energy is produced by a collision of a two-star system. Okay, so we will use this formula very soon. Before we do that, let me just have a remark. On relationship between spin versus radiation and so very simply is that you you can do a multiple expansion for any field you consider, for example for scalar field, electromagnetic field, gravitational field, you do just multiple expansion. Okay, so we have multiple expansion. And of course, this is, you start with a monopole. And then you get a dipole. And then you get a quadrupole. And then you keep going to higher poles. All right. So now, what is super interesting is that if this formula is correct, then whatever we have done here, somehow for gravity, the monopole and dipole are not interesting. I gave you a quadrupole formula, right? So if they were interesting, I would give you dipole formula or monopole formula, right? So somehow the monopole and dipole are not interesting. I will elaborate on the dipole in a minute. But what it means is really, and it's true, gravity is a spin two particle theory. And the lowest multipole it actually radiates is the quadrupole. Okay, so this is where gravity radiates. And that precisely corresponds to the fact that gravity is sort of described by spin two particle. What about electromagnetism? What do you think? So did you see any?
That radiates in electromagnetism.
Exactly. Yeah. What about quadrupole?
The quadrupole is in 1/r².
In electromagnetism? Of course, it does radiate in electromagnetism. So dipole, we know that it radiates in electromagnetism. And that corresponds to the fact that electromagnetism is spin one. But what it means that it radiates, it means that the dipole already radiates, and of course quadrupole will radiate, and higher poles will also radiate. So, but for gravity, the dipole and monopole, they do not, but quadrupole and higher poles, they do radiate. So finally, what about the scalar field?
What about, can we generalize this, for example, with spin half particles?
Well, again, so there are no really classical ways for spin 1/2 particles because it's quantum mechanical. I think you could probably somehow.
But you can talk about the classical Dirac field, the classical spinner field, for example.
Yeah, you could. But then still, you have like an exclusion principle or something like that, which prevents you to. Yeah, I don't know. So monopole, actually, what about the scalar field? Does it radiate as a monopole? Have you taken any course on radiation things? So it does. So the scalar already radiates as a monopole. And so basically, you can also recognize the spin of the particle by which multiple actually already radiates. So for scalar, it will be all multiples will radiate. For electromagnetism, the monopole does not radiate, but dipole, quadrupole, and other things do. For gravity, these two do not radiate, but the quadrupole and higher, they actually do. Okay. So now, of course, this is a problem for detection of gravitational waves, right? So basically, the higher the pole, the weaker the signal. Okay. So that's why, in principle, it will be super simple to detect scalars. We don't detect any, but that's why, you know, the electromagnetic signals are much stronger than the gravity signals, because already dipole radiates and quadrupole, and you need quadrupole for gravity. Okay, in practice, if you see the formulas, the dipole for electromagnetism is something like 2/3 dipole moment, 2 derivatives of there divided by c cubed. Okay, so by any moment with 2 derivatives. As we shall see in a minute, our quadrupole formula for the metric gives us radiation, which depends on the quadrupole 3 dots square, and it's suppressed by c to the 5. Okay, so that's why this is much weaker signal. Okay. Very good. So now, tricky question, of course, which will come to your interview. Can you have spherically symmetric gravitational waves? So start thinking about it already now. Can you have spherically symmetric gravitational waves? What do you think? No, because that would precisely correspond to monopole radiation. Okay. All right.
David?
Yes.
Why is spherically symmetric gravitational waves correspond to monopole radiation?
We will see another proof of that by discussing the Schwarzschild metric in a minute. But certainly, you know, they would correspond to something like a monopole radiation. But monopole radiation doesn't exist in gravity. All right. So now, why dipole does not radiate? Radiate in gravity. So if you do the calculation in electromagnetism, so recall in electromagnetism that the dipole is something like sum over the charges times the positions. Ri. So that's the dipole. Okay. And so then, of course, in order to calculate how much power is radiated away, I just take the 2 derivatives of this dipole, and that gives me the power, the energy per time, how much is radiated by dipole. Okay, so I need to take 2 derivatives of this to find how much energy is radiated away. But now let's assume that that you have a system of particles for which the charge versus mass ratio is fixed. So I have, for example, a system only of electrons, which all of them have fixed E over M. So it's just one ratio. So suppose we have a system composed of particles for which EI divided by MI is simply a constant. So if I take any particle there, the charge versus mass ratio is constant, and it's for all of them, for all I. So for all I. Okay, so if this is the case, then actually I can write this in terms of, so now my dipole is actually, I can write instead of EI, I can write MI times C. Okay, so this is C times sum over MI RI. And then the derivative of the dipole, first time derivative is C times MI times the velocity I. Okay, but what is MI times velocity I? Is, and sum over all possible I is just the total momentum of the system. So this is just C times capital P. Well, this is the total momentum of the system. But of course, we know that our system is isolated or whatever. It's just somewhere, you know, in the flat space. And then you know that there's a conservation of the total momentum. So the system, at most, is moving uniformly somewhere. It cannot start accelerating or something like that. So if I take another time derivative, what do I get? I get zero. Thank you. Okay. So, you know, if this is the case, then simply the two derivatives of dipole are zero, because by conservation of total angular momentum. So this is well, at most uniform motion. And so this is zero, and of course this thing will be also zero because it's just that square. Okay, so then the power, and then no radiation. No dipole radiation. Okay, so that was for electromagnetism. But we know that gravity is nothing else than electromagnetism, where I replace the corresponding charge by the corresponding gravitational mass, right? So then I would have gravitational mass divided by inertial mass. But that's by principle of equivalence, that's a constant, it's one. So in gravity, everything would get replaced by mg over m inertial, which we know is constant, and it's won by the equivalence principle. Hence the whole argument applies here automatically. And so there cannot be any dipole radiation in gravitational field. Isn't that beautiful? Oh no, this one is also broken. Okay, very good. Questions? Okay, so now we understand what the field is. We understand why the field is actually given by the quadrupole formula, why it cannot be a dipole formula. Monopole formula even comes from something simpler than this. Okay, so now finally, let's calculate how much power is actually radiated away in these gravitational waves. So let's derive this formula here. Okay, so to that, you really need to know how much energy is carried by gravitational field. So the last thing is energy loss due to gravitational radiation. And this is a very interesting chapter in general relativity history. Of course, the right answer was already known in, I don't know, 30s, 40s, by a gentleman called Landau and Lifshitz. But of course, they were Russians, and so nobody, you know, Nobody paid attention to what they actually discovered. And so then it basically took until 60s when there was a conference in US where people just started discussing, you know, gravitational waves and how much energy they carry and so on. And then you can read about this conference in Feynman's notes, and surely you must be joking, Mr. Feynman, where he is like how he was super depressed that these people don't understand anything and they don't ask the right questions, right? They always ask, you know, can I write energy momentum tensor for gravitational field or whatever, and they couldn't, right? Because we know there's no energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field. But he was saying, like, you should be asking a question, can gravitational waves do any work? And so actually they can, and this will be the answer for that question. All right, but anyway, so people in the end figured it out. So then we know that, recall that we argued, that the energy stored in gravitational field, that the energy of gravitational field, and this was just an argument based on, you know, the analogy with electromagnetism, is that we knew that in electromagnetism the energy is actually given by the derivatives of the field. So it's dA square, which is like E square plus B square, that's the energy density. So we argued similarly that the energy of the gravitational field should look something like dG square, or if you want, gamma square. Right? So this is what we, by analogy with electromagnetism, so by analogy with electromagnetism, this should be the case. But you know, the immediate problem is that, of course, this is not a tensor. And so then I was trying to say that maybe, you know, in one system, if you are in a freely falling system, you don't see any energy of the gravitational field. On the other hand, if you are not in freely falling system and use other coordinates, this will be some contribution. But if I change coordinates, it will be a different contribution. So the problem is that this is not a tensor, right? Problem, of course, is that gamma is not a tensor. And so it sees this is like problematic notion. But gamma is almost a tensor, right? So it has the nice transformation, and then it has a bloody term which has two derivatives, d square xi over dx mu dx nu, right? So that was the transformation property of the gamma. But of course, that term is not important if you just do Lorentz transformations. Okay, so it is not a tensor in full GR, but it is if you just consider flat space and you consider Lorentz transformation. But it is in flat space, or almost flat space, and under Lorentz transformations. Okay, so what that tells you is that basically, well, we may not be able to define the energy momentum tensor for the gravitational field in arbitrary curved space, but if we are sufficiently close to flat space, maybe the object actually should be there. And maybe if I just, you know, allow transformations which are sort of like Lorentz transformations, this thing will behave nicely under these transformations. Okay, so let's search for it. Okay, so now the problem is that there is 101 of these tensors. And they are named by different after different people. And if you can come up with a new form of your own and can convince other people that this is a good form, then you can have an energy momentum tensor of gravitational field named by you. Okay, so now let me discuss two of them. And as I say, well, they are in general different. Each of them is different. Each of them has different prescription. Yes?
I don't understand why in platic space is tensor.
So if you just remember the transformation property of the gamma, so you had something like gamma is, so it has three indices, so it's d over d of gamma, plus, and there was an annoying term, which was like d square over d, and then something else. So of course, this thing here will vanish if I just consider Lorentz transformations. If I just consider Lorentz transformation is x prime is lambda times x. If I take two derivatives, I get zero, and so this term vanishes. So then actually it transforms as a tensor. Thank you for that question. Other questions like that? All right, so let's have. So as I said, so you have different forms of the Timuonyu for the gravitational field. And depending on who made it, the expressions are different, the tensors are different. However, they better give the same physical prediction. Right? So if I actually construct something like how much energy is lost in my system, all these predictions better agree. Otherwise, your tensor is not useful. Right? All right, so then let me first do this very elegant construction due to Landau and Lifshitz. So first, Landau and Lifshitz prescription. And you see that, ideologically, this is super simple. Unfortunately, the corresponding Timuonyu is super ugly. Okay, but anyway, so let's do this first. So we know that in any reference frame, Napla mu G mu nu equals to zero. That's it's a Bianchi identity. It's always true. Okay, so we know this. So now the idea of Landau and Lifshitz is to say, so this is true in any coordinate system, but let's look at this in a special coordinate system, in a freely falling system. So now in freely falling system, of course my gammas are equal to zero. There are no Christoffel symbols. And this equation just reduces to partial mu. G mu equals to zero, right? Because I just said gamma equal to zero. All gammas equal to zero, so this must be true. Okay. So now is this interesting construction. So how do you make sure that this is true in any freely falling system for any metric? Right? So for any metric, whatever the metric I take, as long as I have gamma equal to zero, this will be true.
But you only do that at a point, right?
Sure. Yeah. Of course. So then to satisfy this identically, in this freely falling system, what they say is that, let's define G mu nu to be a derivative of a superpotential. So this is given by D kappa S kappa mu nu, where this is called a superpotential. Superpotential. And so superpotential, of course, I want that G mu nu is symmetric in mu and nu. So this guy will be symmetric here in mu and nu. But I want this to be an identically satisfied. So if I apply d mu on this, I want that this gives me automatically zero. Okay, so I can achieve that by a simple trick, by saying that this superpotential is antisymmetric in the first two indices. So if I require that the superpotential is antisymmetric in kappa and mu, then of course d mu of g mu nu is just d mu d kappa s mu kappa nu. But this is antisymmetric, this is symmetric, so it's automatically equal to zero. Okay, so let's assume that we can find the superpotential. Of course, you can do it explicitly. You can find what the superpotential is. And the formula is actually quite simple. So how you do it is that you take your g mu nu and you switch off gammas everywhere. So you have an expression for g mu nu, which is something like gamma gamma minus gamma gamma d gamma d gamma, right? So of course the gamma gamma terms, they do vanish because I'm in freely falling frame. So it's just given by d gamma, right? And so So then it's not surprising that I can write this formula d gamma minus d gamma as d of some superpotential s, which you can explicitly write down. Okay, so that's super simple. So we can find s kappa lambda mu explicitly. And that's actually not that difficult. Okay, it's a couple of lines. All right, so now this was all in the freely falling frame. Now let's go back. So now in general frame, so if I have returned back to my curve coordinates or whatever, not freely falling frame, of course the expression for the Einstein tensor will now have gamma gamma terms, right? So there, it will have the thing, and so you can take whatever the potential gives you. So you can take d kappa s kappa mu nu, and then subtract d mu nu, the full one, right? So I know what this is. I found it previously, so I just take the divergence of that, and I know what that is in general curve space. So it's gamma gamma minus gamma gamma and whatever. So you see that the difference is probably something like gamma gamma terms, right? So this is something like gamma gamma terms. So this will be non-trivial. It's something like gamma gamma, and so you just define this to be 8 pi g tau mu nu. Difference between the two, and so this is your gravitational energy momentum tensor. Well, that's the definition of tau mu nu. Now this is Landau and Lifshitz gravitational pseudo tensor. Why pseudo? Because of course it's not a tensor. Why is not a tensor? This guy is a tensor. Well, this guy is not a tensor, right? It's only Lorentzian tensor. Okay, so it's something like gamma gamma. Well, this is something like gamma gamma. Okay, so why is it reasonable to call this a tensor of the gravitational field? Well, first of all, you notice that tau mu nu is symmetric under the exchange of mu and nu from the construction, right? This guy is symmetric in mu and nu. This guy is symmetric in mu and nu. So this guy is symmetric in mu and nu. So this is symmetric in mu and nu. But also, I can use the Einstein equations. But also, upon the use of the Einstein equations, I can write that g mu nu is 8 pi g t mu nu of the matter, right? So now I use the Einstein equations and I put this term here on the right hand side. So then you have, so also using Einstein equation, you can just write d kappa s kappa mu nu equals to 8 pi g t mu nu plus tau mu nu. Everybody happy? So I just used the Einstein equations. I wrote the Einstein tensor as 8 pi g t mu nu, and I put it on the right hand side instead of on the left hand side. All right. So we are basically done. So that's the form of your Einstein equations now. Okay, so this is nothing else than the Einstein equations, but written in a different form than you are used to. So the difference is that now we write it in terms of some superpotential instead of the Einstein tensor, but we pick up an extra term on the right-hand side. Okay, so what happens if I apply d mu on the equation? So if I applying d mu on the equation, what do I get on the left hand side?
Zero.
You get zero because this guy is by construction antisymmetric in kappa and mu. Okay, so the left hand side is zero. And the right-hand side is just d mu, t mu nu plus tau mu nu equals to 0. So we get that 0 is d mu of t mu nu plus tau mu nu. But what does it mean? It means, huh?
Sorry, that whatever energy that matter loses must go into space-time. And
exactly.
Sum of space and matter, exactly. Space-time and matter energy that is conserved.
Perfect. So what it means is that we have now a conserved energy momentum tensor, which is t mu nu plus tau mu nu, which is conserved. But of course, we know this is just the energy momentum tensor of the matter. And we know from physics intuition that only the energy momentum tensor of matter plus gravitational field is conserved. Okay, so this must be energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field interacting with our matter. Okay, so the total energy momentum tensor of matter plus gravity is conserved. Okay, and so this is the beautiful construction. So really, you know, you have now conserved energy of gravitational field plus energy of matter, and now these are together, they are conserved. Okay, and so that's what you would expect. So of course you can write down the expression for tau mu nu explicitly, and it's not a nice expression. All right, so you basically, you have to, so this is your definition of that tau mu nu, and you just go to Landau and Lipschitz, and it's like four lines expression for tau mu nu. Anyway, you can use this energy momentum tensor for gravitational field if you like. Questions? Yes?
So this is a covariant derivative then.
So this is a partial derivative.
So it's not quite the same as our.
Exactly. So you always know that nabla mu t mu nu equals to 0, right? You know this. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't give you any conservation law unless you have Killing vectors, mm-hmm. because there is no corresponding Stokes theorem. Here, you are pretending you are almost in flat space, but not quite. There is still some energy momentum of the gravitational field, mm-hmm. right, which is captured by this guy. And then the total thing is actually conserved in the standard sense. Mm-hmm. Right? So then you have a conservation law.
I'm just not quite understanding. So the way we constructed the superpotential is by setting g mu nu to derivative. And then we defined that their difference to be this.
But that construction there was in the freely falling frame. So I was setting all gammas equal to 0. So now I write this in general frame where I restore my gammas. Right?
Okay.
So the difference will be precisely something like gamma-gamma terms.
The gammas are in G mu? Like where do you
the gammas are here, of course. So you know, the expression for G mu nu is gamma-gamma minus gamma-gamma plus D gamma minus D gamma, right? So D gamma terms are captured here, mm-hmm. right? Because they are non-trivial even in the freely falling frame. But if I go to a general frame, I also have gamma-gamma terms. And so this tau mu nu is something like gamma square, which is what we predicted by just an analogy with electromagnetism, what it has to be, right? So this is the correct answer. All right, so let me just tell you another way how you can construct this. And so when you are asked about the energy momentum tensor in your interview, you can choose whichever you like more, whether the Landau-Lipschitz or whether you like more the one which I now construct through the perturbation theory. Or maybe you like another one and you come up with your own proposal for an energy momentum tensor. And if you convince me this is the right one, then you will pass the interview. All right. So, a different construction, a different tensor. Construction is as follows, and maybe this will be a little bit closer. I think this is really super beautiful and super nice. This is closer to what you have done in your homework too. Okay, so what we want to do is that we have q mu nu equals to zero, our vacuum Einstein equations. And so you want to solve perturbatively order by order. In perturbations, meaning I choose my metric g mu nu to be the flat metric eta mu nu plus a small perturbation h mu nu plus another perturbation h mu nu 2 plus another perturbation h mu nu 3, where I simply treat this thing to be of order of O h squared. So I treat this is like a linear perturbation. This is my quadratic perturbation. So if I take h mu nu squared, it's of the same order as the second perturbation here. Okay, so you want to do this. You want to solve g mu nu equal to 0 by doing the perturbation theory. All right, so let's do it order by order. So zeroth order. In the zeroth order, I just take eta mu nu. Okay, so then I have g mu nu of eta. What is that? G mu nu of eta.
Zero.
It's zero automatically, right? So this is zero automatically because we are in flat space. And of course, I require it's equal to zero, so I solve my Einstein equation automatically, right? So that's good. So zero order is trivial. Then first order. Okay, so then you consider g mu nu and evaluate it on eta plus h. Okay, so it's g mu nu evaluated on eta, which is 0. So this is g mu nu, let's call it linear, on h. And so this will be some expression for g mu nu linear. We had that expression yesterday. On the blackboard, right? That's what you have done in your homework. You have expanded g mu nu into the linear order in perturbation h, and that gives you the linearized gravity, right? So this gives you some equation for h, and what you require is that this equation is equal to zero. So this is the linearized gravity. What is super important here is that, of course, this g mu nu satisfies the Bianchi identity. Well, this g mu nu linear, what you found in your thing, also satisfies the Bianchi identity, but the linearized one. Okay, we also have that d mu g mu nu linearized equals to zero. Zero for any metric h, because this is just a linearized Bianchi identity, and you can check that explicitly in your homework, right? So you found expression for g mu nu linear, you explicitly wrote it down. It has six terms, I think, and so now you can apply d mu, and you will see that this is identically equal to zero for whatever the h is, right? So you can check that explicitly. All right, so that's what first order gives us. So now the interesting part is the second order. Okay, so now you go to second order. That's a little bit more work than you did in your homework. Okay, so you go to the second order. So now you write g mu nu, g mu nu of eta plus h plus of h2. Okay, so g mu nu on eta is zero. Then g mu nu, okay, so this is g mu nu linear acting on h plus g mu nu linear acting on h2 plus g mu nu quadratic acting on H, right? So I'm expanding to the order OH square, right? So I can have either the linear part evaluated on H2, or I can have a quadratic part in H. They are of the same order. All right, but we know what that this guy is zero from the previous order, first order. We require this to be equal to zero. So this is the requirement that this is equal to zero. And so then we are getting a beautiful equation. And in order to satisfy this, I have to have that G mu nu linear, G mu nu linear on H2 equals 2 minus G mu nu quadratic on H. Let's define that to be 8 pi G tau mu nu, where tau mu nu is minus 1 over 8 pi G G mu nu quadratic on H. Okay, everybody happy with this? So we just, you know, set the first, so we require that the whole thing is equal to zero. Well, we are solving perturbatively our Einstein equation. We know that from the previous order that the first term is zero, that was in the linear order. And then we have this has to be equal to minus that. Okay, so let's write it. So I just rename this G mu nu quadratic to be T mu nu. Why does this make sense to call it T mu nu? Well, it is something which actually we are trying to solve. From the first order, we solve for the linear perturbation. Right? So here, this is our equation for H. So by solving this equation, we know what H is, right? In the first order. So in fact, if we call tau mu nu to be this thing here, whatever this operator is, it acts on something which we already know. So this is actually a known source, okay? But we don't know what H2 is. So we are solving for the new metric H2, which is the source given by the previous order, okay? So now it remains to be shown that G mu nu quadratic of H is nothing else than just you take the Einstein tensor and you expand into the second order in H. So this is nothing else than the Einstein tensor expanded to second order. All right, and so we can actually calculate the tau mu nu, and this is what you will call the energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field. Okay, so of course, such energy momentum tensor of the gravitational field is conserved. Why is it conserved? So let's call running super late. That's okay. Know that. So tau mu nu is of course symmetric. So tau mu nu is the energy momentum tensor, G momentum tensor of gravitational field. It's different one from the Landau-Wendefschitz tensor, but it's also a tensor, and it satisfies that d mu tau mu nu equals to zero. So remember, we are just solving this in vacuum, so we don't have any matter here. So it's like the Landau's formula where you set T mu nu equals to zero. Okay, why is this? What do you think? Why this is true?
Because G satisfies this.
Exactly. So now you look at this equation here. You have G mu nu linear is 8 pi G tau mu nu. But if you apply d mu on both sides of the equation, then you have d mu g mu nu linear. But you know from this order that d mu, g mu nu linear equals to zero on any metric, right? Because d mu, g mu nu linear equals to zero on any metric. And so then you are getting as a consistency that d mu tau mu nu has to be equal to zero. And so we are done. So this is our t mu nu, tau mu nu. And all you have to do is just extend your homework and not expand your Einstein tensor to the first order, but expand it to the second order in H. Okay, so this will, okay. So I'm running out of time, so let me just say that such tau mu nu, yes?
I was just wondering, so now this is a tensor?
Of course not.
Okay.
So energy momentum pseudo tensor. Pseudo tensor gravitational field. So again, you know, this is not a tensor equation, right? It's a Lorentz tensor equation. So if you are in flat space, this will be this is a Lorentz tensor. But it's not a tensor under general coordinate transformation. Okay, so the expression which you get from here is again a little bit ugly, but what people say is that they coarse grain the spacetime. So they say something like, "Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make sense to discuss the gravitational energy localized at a point. I can always go to a freely falling frame. So let's consider instead of a point a neighborhood." In the neighborhood, I cannot really go to a freely falling frame. So I'm getting rid of the thing of like localization of the gravitational energy. So then, effectively, what this amounts to is that you can integrate by parts and throw away the boundary terms. You say that the energy is somewhere here. I can get rid of it on an integral around that source of energy. And then, so you can integrate by parts. So by integrating by parts, which corresponds to coarse graining of spacetime, you get a relatively simple expression, certainly simpler one than you get from Landauer-Lifshitz prescription, and it's written by my formula 544. So tau mu nu is given by 1 over 32 pi g. And then you have, this is the coarse graining thing. So d mu h rho sigma d nu h rho sigma plus the other terms. OK, so this is what it is. So you have a couple more terms here. But what is funny is that if you use your Lorentz gauge condition, if you use the Lorentz gauge, all the other terms vanish. Okay, so these terms vanish if one uses for under using the Lorentz gauge condition. Or the harmonic gauge. Okay, and so this is your tau mu nu. This is how much energy is stored in gravitational waves. All right, so that was painful, right? So, but we can assign to gravitational field some energy momentum tensor. It's only a Lorentz tensor. It's not a tensor under general coordinate transformations. It cannot be because gravitational energy is not really, you can get rid of gravity in the freely falling frame. All right, so the last step to calculate the gravitational radiation is really to say, well, okay, so how much energy is carried by gravitational waves from our system? So now we know that this is described by this tau mu nu. And so now, last thing is the power formula. Power formula is that the power irradiated by the system. So how much energy is radiated per time t is an integral over sphere at infinity, or very large radius, of the energy flux of the gravitational waves. Okay, what is the energy flux? So tau tt is the energy density of the gravitational waves. Tau t nu is the energy flux carried by gravitational waves. So now if I calculate how much flux goes through my area, that's the energy carried away by time. Okay, so this is given by tau t mu. And then I'm integrating over the sphere at infinity. That's where the r square comes from. And then the normal of the sphere, and then the omega is my integral over the sphere. So this is the energy flux through that sphere. And I integrate this thing here. All right. So now this is the formula, and it's super simple, right? We know what tau t mu is. It's given by this formula here. It's just given by the derivatives of the perturbation. These terms I can throw away. So this is just the derivatives of the perturbation. But we also know, oh no, we don't know, what the perturbation is. It's given by our quadrifold formula. That's what we derived, right? So we derived that well, you know, what this perturbation looks like for a distant observer. Right, so we know, so this comes from the quadrupole formula. And all we have to do is that we have to use that quadrupole formula thing, plug it here, and calculate the tau, and then integrate over the sphere. Okay, the quadrupole formula gives us like 1 over r. But now we have 1 over r square, so that cancels that r square, and we get a finite result. So that means r goes to infinity, of course. But also, you notice that you have a derivative of the metric, right? The metric in the quadrupole formula was given by two derivatives of the quadrupole. Okay, so now this thing has another derivative of that. So it's not surprising that the result will depend on three derivatives of the quadrupole. It will be three times derivatives of the quadrupole. So now the actual derivation takes a couple of pages. If you are interested, look it up in Sean Carroll's book, but it's not important. So what is important is the result. So the result, so this is equal to a couple of pages. Couple of pages to make it look nice. And so what you are getting in the end is that the power equals to g over 5 c to the 5, and then q ij 3 dots, so 3 times derivatives of qij times qij 3 dots here, and then you average that over space-time. So that's the power formula. It's also called quadrupole formula to make it more confusing. The quadrupole formula. Formula to distinguish it from the quadrupole formula for the perturbation of the metric, let's call it for the power. And this is how much energy is carried away by gravitational waves, which are produced by a system whose quadrupole moment is changing according to this. So you start with a system that has some quadrupole moment. You take three derivatives of that quadrupole moment, average over space and time, and this gives you the power irradiated away. All right, so now the crude estimate is super simple. So let's estimate this power. Okay, so what is quadrupole? It's energy times length square. Okay, so the quadrupole simply goes, mass is energy. So if you have a system of mass m, then quadrupole is something like mass times length square. Length is the characteristic length of the system. So that's the quadrupole. ML squared. All right, so then we need the time derivatives of the quadrupole. So it's something like, well, there must be some characteristic time scale in the play. So there's a characteristic time scale, characteristic time scale. So for example, the orbit, orbital period of the system, time scale. And that is, let's call it t. But of course, I can relay that with the frequency of how often this actually goes around. So this is 1 over omega. Yeah?
Is q different from the I we introduced?
Ah, thank you so much. Thank you for that. Stupid me. So this q is basically the I, but make it traceless. Okay, so that comes from the calculation, simply. So what q is, thank you so much for that. So q ij is ij minus 1/3 delta ij of I, where I is the trace. So you take your quadrupole as we define it above there, and you subtract its trace. And that's the q which enters this formula. It comes from the calculation. Thank you so much for that question. Any other screw-ups? Okay. Okay, so very good. So now let's estimate the power of this. So we have the quadrupole. We have this characteristic time scale of how the system is changing, or you know what is the frequency it, for example, rotates, right? So then, what is this power? The power is just given by g over c to the 5, and then now I'm super puzzled by my own notes. So g over c to the 5. Then we have quadrupole q. And there's another quadrupole. So it's quadrupole square. So it's m square l to the 4. M square l to the 4. And then we have divided by time. So we have three derivatives with respect to time there, and three derivatives with respect to time there. So it gives us omega to power 6. Okay, so this is the estimate for how much power is radiated by a system which rotates, let's say, with frequency omega, and the size of the system is L, and the mass of the system is M. All right. So, yes?
How well is this formula, verified?
Okay, very good. okay, so now you may be asking stupid questions. So let's test this formula for some nice object. So let's take a rod, which is 1 meter long, so L is 1, and the mass is 1 kilogram, and the frequency of the rotation, I'm rotating the rod, is 1 hertz. Okay, so for rod of L equal to 1 meter, and M equal to 1 kilogram, and then omega equal to 1 hertz. Well, not really like this, but something like that, right? And then you rotate that. Of course, as it rotates, it produces gravitational waves. Okay? So now you can calculate the power of how much gravitational waves is actually produced by that, and you find that the power is something like 10 to minus 52 watts. Okay? Not a big power. Okay, so really, that doesn't help much. So then you take another system. Let's say, okay, so let's abandon simple things and let's go to the space. So then you may be asking, so for example, Jupiter. So it's actually evolving around the sun. It's quite heavy, right? And the length of the system is the distance from the sun to Jupiter, and the frequency is I don't know how many years. The period is how many years. But Jupiter is very heavy. So then you can calculate this power for Jupiter. And what do you think you find? Still not much. You find 5 kilowatts. Okay. So for Jupiter, you find P something like 5 kilowatts. Okay, so then you think, you know, this is completely useless formula. There will never be anything which you can actually verify. But then there comes the observation by Taylor and House. So 1974, Taylor and House. And what they looked at was a pulsating binary system. So spinning binary system. So they had a pulsar in the binary system. So pulsar some number, 1913 plus 16. And so for that, so you had a binary star system, and then you could, because one of them is a pulsar, you see actually the pulse is coming to you under some frequency. So you can measure precisely the orbital period of the system. And then what they measured is that actually this thing, as the system is going around, it loses energy because it radiates gravitational waves. So it starts very slowly here, and then it sort of falls closer and closer and starts speeding up, right? So you are speeding up. So you see the pulse is coming in a shorter and shorter time period. Okay, and so they could measure the time period. And then they thought, well, the system just radiates gravitational waves. Let's calculate the power of how much. And they measured the mass of the system and everything. And so the power here was actually 10 to 48 watts. Okay, so this is a huge power. And that corresponds to degrees of the orbital period of t, which they could precisely measure. And it surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, of course, everybody knows that general relativity is correct. So it exactly matched this predicted formula, the quadrupole formula here. So of course, they got a Nobel Prize for this. That's the second Nobel Prize for general relativity, which is much earlier than that one here. But it's the first indirect confirmation of the existence of gravitational waves. And at that time, it was the most precise experiment in physics ever. So not considering QED or whatever, this was even more precise than that, okay, at the time. So this is a second Nobel Prize. So let me stop here. So really, gravitational waves now confirmed both indirectly through this experiment, through really just, you know, how much energy the system is losing. But now they are also directly observed. And they are really, you see these patterns in the LIGO. So let me stop here and let me start like holes tomorrow.